This is 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
The views and opinions of this program are those of its host and guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Midcoast Radio Project, or its staff and volunteers.
Welcome once again to this edition of the KKFI Arts Magazine Show. I'm Michael Hogue, your host. Glad to have you with us on this Monday here in the city as you listen to the Arts Magazine Show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station, right here in Kansas City. We're going to talk the opera today in the first half hour of the program. Love is never a sure bet. That's one of the themes of the new Lyric Opera presentation, Così Fan Tutte. They're nodding their heads in approval. I'm so happy. Everyone knows, everyone that listens to the show knows, I'm weak on some of my Italian, especially, pronunciations. Patrick Carfisi is with us. He plays the role of Don Alfonso, and John Viscardi is with us as well. He was with the inaugural class of the resident artist at the Lyric Opera.
That's correct.
And yeah, I'm
glad to be back.
I'll ask him a few things about what that was like. Let's go to Patrick first then.
Sure.
Met the Metropolitan Opera, and he just told an interesting story before we began about the Metropolitan Opera. Wiesbaden, Germany, the San Diego Opera, Houston Grand, where he did Nixon in China. If you were going to look at him, you'd get an idea right away which part he had. Henry Kissinger.
My grandmother always said that I looked like Henry, so there we go.
And you do. And you do. Opera Philadelphia, the San Diego Opera, the Central City Opera, Lyric Opera Chicago, and many, many more. I was getting a cramp. I had to stop writing.
Thank you. Nice to have you with us. Great to be with you.
Nice to have you, John Viscardi, as I said. The inaugural class of the resident artist here at the Lyric, Opera Carolina, Michigan Opera, Carnegie Hall. You know that old joke, how do you get to Carnegie Hall?
I've heard it.
Practice. The Bar Harbor Music Festival. I know I'm not going to get this right. Venezia International Festival.
Great.
But yeah. That's close enough. Yeah. That rarely happens. San Luis Obispo, that one I can say. And many others, of course. Santa Fe, Opera Philadelphia. Many others as well. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Today, we're going to talk about this opera. Tell me a little bit about the storyline. Now, sometimes people get the impression, people that aren't really familiar with the opera, they'll say, they sing in a different language. How do I follow what the storyline is? Things work out well. There's a translation. The program is usually very good about putting out the storyline. So that is not really a concern, but there is a storyline to this opera.
Absolutely. Absolutely, yes. I mean, the underlying title of the work is called The School for Lovers, and it is indeed one large, long, lovely education that is implemented by the character I play, Don Alfonso. And Don Alfonso says to the gentlemen, Guglielmo and Ferrando, I will make you this bet that your ladies will learn to love someone else. And the boys, as we'll call them, Ferrando and Guglielmo, are both determined that no, they're Dorabella and Fiordaligi, they will love them forever. They will be faithful forever. There is no doubt in either of their minds. So they make a very small bet. And Alfonso takes this bet and says, okay, fine. For the next period of time, you have to do exactly what I say. Do what I say, do what I tell you to do, and let's see what the outcome will be. And the boys do. And then we cut to the ladies, and the ladies are sitting there absolutely enjoying their love of their two gentlemen, and in walks their friend, and depending on how we play it, lady servant, Despina. And Despina is also a friend of Alfonso. So Despina and Alfonso, over the course of the show, kind of manipulate the ladies and the gentlemen into place and make this really interesting story come to life while providing quite a unique education for all involved, including themselves.
Ah, very interesting. You must be very trusting gentlemen. That's all I have to say. Absence does not necessarily make the heart always grow faster.
Well, one thing that I think is interesting about my character, Guglielmo, in the context of the story, as Patrick just outlined it, is that he says at the beginning of the show, it's impossible for Fiordaligi to ever cheat on me. Not that she would ever be unfaithful to a lover, but that she would never, it was impossible for her to be unfaithful to him, because he has such a sort of specific impression of himself and the way that he walks around in the world. And this is sort of what gets him in trouble. He's blinded by his own confidence in this sense.
Hmm. And you have four distinct personality types amongst the lovers, amongst Guglielmo, Ferrando, Fiordaligi, and Dorabella. You have four.
You're really good at that. Patrick, you are great.
I did grow up in an Italian-speaking household, thankfully, albeit dialect. No, you have four distinct personality types, and you'll see archetypes on stage. You'll see the kind of the character of Guglielmo, who's very much confident in himself and very forward in the way that he approaches things, very direct. You'll see Ferrando is a bit more meditative, a bit more of the poet, and so on and so forth. And you see how these all play together. It's kind of fun.
Sounds like it is a lot of fun. It opens up on Saturday the 16th, this coming Saturday at 7:30 p.m. Performances will then continue on Wednesday the 20th at 7:30, Friday the 22nd at 7:30, and closes out with a matinee on Sunday the 24th at 2 o'clock p.m. at the Muriel Kaufman side of the Kaufman Center. The number to call for more information, 816-471-7344, or online at kcopera.org. We're speaking with Patrick and John. Let's hear from John's perspective about his character.
Sure. Well,
because sometimes people have a different perspective.
Absolutely. I think this guy is a very interesting character to play. It was a difficult one for me to fully invest in, because by the end of this opera, and I don't want to give away the whole story, but by the end of this opera, he refuses to take ownership and responsibility for his actions, for the situation that he's found himself in, and the situation that he has sort of caused some of his friends and his lover to be in. And I think that this is an aspect of the human condition that we all sort of face, where we have a hard time sometimes taking responsibility for our actions. And I think that this is an incredibly important lesson for people to learn. It certainly was for myself. And I think Mozart and De Ponte they're genius in their ability to tell these stories. And my whole objective with Guglielmo is to portray this guy, this masculine man who sort of defines himself by his masculinity, his what he considers soldier's honor, as clearly and as strongly as possible, so that by the end of the story, the audience can sort of see that it was indeed his inability to take responsibility for his actions that got him into the unfavorable position that he's in today. And I think that if the worst thing that could happen for me at the end of the show is an audience member walks away feeling bad for Guglielmo and the situation that he's in by the end of the story.
Ah.
I don't want anyone to feel that way.
Okay, you heard it. Don't feel that
don't
way.
Don't feel bad for it.
when you go to see the show, when it opens on Saturday the 16th, I'm always fascinated by the acting abilities of some of the opera performers. Now, it's all done through singing. Mm-hmm. It's all done through singing, so, you say, well, how... they probably just go through the motions. They probably walk around and sing, and that's the story. But I have found some of the best acting I've seen on stage, because you're forced to do more things through expression, mm-hmm. and movement and gestures, mm-hmm. and all that. Was that difficult to get into? Did you act in, say, plays when you were younger and kind of translated that over?
I really found my acting ability in opera. It wasn't... I had done plays and musicals throughout middle school, high school, college, and it wasn't until Pelléas et Mélisande at the Academy of Vocal Arts in Philadelphia that I found this sort of realism of expression through the storytelling, this ability to just look at these individuals as human beings and treat them as such, and then really just take each character for who they are in this world that they're operating in and just try to get into their head. And it was through the stories, the operatic stories, that I found that.
Yeah, for me, I grew up doing lots and lots of community theater from a very, very young age. Had one particular community theater group that I worked with every summer for 7 years. And I learned a lot of stagecraft from that. I also studied formally when I went to Catholic University and after that at Yale. But a great deal of what I've learned has also been, operatically, has been through the different productions and opportunities that I've had over the years. And going back to Mozart and De Ponte, they're amazing teachers when it comes to being an actor. The way we read into what they've given us, the way that we listen to Mozart, the way that we see this amazing blend that they've done dramatically in terms of storytelling, it's endless. It's absolutely endless in terms of how much you can mine from it and how much you can learn from them every time. I've done Marriage of Figaro, another Mozart de Ponte collaboration. I've done that opera more than 100 times, more than 100 performances, and every single performance feels unique because there is such depth to these ideas and these characters, and that's the fuel for the fire. That is from which the acting develops. That's from which the gesture comes, be it musical or physical. So that journey is the journey that one of the journeys that I enjoy the most in terms of being on stage and then having the spontaneous moment and then having the joy of the human interaction and the fact that you and your colleagues come to the stage with a new idea every night. It is not a matter of repetition. It is a matter of rediscovery.
But you've done it like 100 times. Well, one, you must really enjoy doing that.
I do love it, yes. Yeah. Deeply.
And secondly, you find something in it, in each stop along the way, probably not each individual performance, but just say if you did it, say in St. Louis or Dallas, you try to find a different way of doing it, perhaps?
A different way, or just a way that it matures, a way that it evolves within you and between you and your colleagues on stage, in collaboration with the conductor, in collaboration with the director. You find different parts of yourself, different parts of others, but then you find different avenues and different little side streets, as it were, in the storytelling.
Oh, sure. Now, I'm guessing a little bit here, but I would think that the more you do a particular opera, the more you get offers to do that opera.
Hopefully. We always like it. Re-engagement is always lovely, and if it's a piece that you already know, it's a great opportunity to dig even deeper into that piece.
What about John? Is that something of your experience?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think one thing I was thinking about as Patrick was just saying this speaks to the uniqueness of every director's interpretation of an opera. You never have the same cast twice, and you never have the same combination of cast and director. And it's so interesting to me to see how a director interprets the role and interprets the work, and then how that sort of colors in some way your interpretation of that role as well, you also have to speak to the music director, the conductor's role in that as well, and the influence that they play. It's huge. I mean, in our rehearsals for this show in particular, it's this collaboration between the cast members, the director James, and the conductor Jane, where we are all looking for different aspects of the score, different aspects of the libretto, and saying, what is this telling us about this character? Or what is this telling us about how you should be moving right now? What you should be doing with your arms? What does this fermata say about what's happening between these two people? And it's that interplay between all of us, the score and the libretto, that makes the work what it is. And that's never the same. Every time you go into that, it's going to be something different.
It's just like any story that anyone would tell. Anytime we tell a story, it's always going to have slight variations. Mm-hmm. It's going to have unique moments in that day. There's going to be a unique emphasis that we give to a particular part of the story that either we remember differently in that moment, or we find something unique in that moment that strikes us in a way that when we're communicating that story, it's going to be unique in every iteration.
And I think that, as you were saying, we change as human beings every day. Every moment we're changing and growing. And you take from your experience, from your worldview, and put onto these characters. And as that changes, your interpretation of the character changes.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Tell me about some of your colleagues in the show. Have you worked with some of these people on past shows?
Yeah, I've worked with Ardo Rebella, mm-hmm. Daniela Mack. We actually just worked this summer together in Santa Fe. I've worked with our maestro, Jane Glover, in Houston. Everyone else, I think this is... Oh, and I've worked with Maureen McKay, who's our Despina. So yeah, that is another one of the real treasures of what we do, is that our circles keep touching each other as we go from city to city, from show to show, from experience to experience.
Could be Kansas City, could be somewhere in Europe.
Could be Kansas City, could be San Diego, could be somewhere in Europe, could be Japan. You never know.
Oh, you opera people, you travel a lot. When I interview people, they've been all over the world.
One of the perks. It is one of the perks. It absolutely is. They don't tend to build opera houses in bad places.
No, they don't. Have you ever worked, I don't see it on my notes, but the one in Australia, the building looks so impressive.
Oh, in Sydney, yeah.
Yeah. I was lucky enough to work there once, right at the beginning of my career.
One performer compared that to the Kauffman Center. Was he just being boastful?
No, I think there's something visually similar between
for sure.
Between the house in Sydney and the Kauffman Center.
Does that affect what you have to do voice-wise?
The Kauffman Center is a spectacular acoustic. It is. I do not know the architects and the designers who built it by name, but I know that they have several other projects that they've done in the past 10 to 15 years. And it's a spectacular acoustic. They understood so thoroughly and beautifully how to build a house for natural sound production without any kind of miking at all. It's really a stunningly beautiful house to sing in.
Yes.
How do those historic, for instance, European opera houses, how do they differ, if they do, from the opera houses here in the United States? They're smaller, I've been told.
The majority of them are smaller, yes. There were theaters in the U.S. That were built in a larger tradition. And so you have 3,000, 3,200 seats at the Met. You have nearly 4,000 places. The houses in Europe tend to be 2,200 and less. The house in Wiesbaden, you mentioned, is 1,000 seats. I think that the house here in Kansas City is basically a modern iteration of a house, a European house.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, think of the Academy in Philadelphia, yeah. Which is a gorgeous, glorious house.
Yeah.
And it's... a spectacular acoustic, and you know, built. I don't know what this capacity is, but it's built
2,700, I think,
yeah.
Like that.
But it's built in kind of an old world style, one would say.
And I think also an element of the design that really affects acoustic for natural production, as Patrick was saying, is the number of balconies and how close those balconies are to the stage. Where in the States, we oftentimes find that we have these houses that we call barns. They're just these huge, open, you know, one or two balconies at most, but very wide, deep houses that are particularly challenging to sing in. You have to make sure you're singing out or you're singing in the places where you know there's the voice will resonate and bounce off of the wall or whatever hard surface you have. And in some of these other houses in Europe, these European houses, they're much more vertically oriented. They go up pretty high, and they're close to the stage, and that really helps. And I think Kauffman, it reproduces that really well. It's not a hard house to sing in.
Yeah, touching on that, I've noticed from attending shows, it does not appear any of you are mic'd ever.
No. One ever mic'd.
So nope. You learn to project to the up back row, which in some cases is pretty far up there.
Yes, we do.
It can be far away. Thankfully,
you just learn to do that in your training over the years, to project to the very back row.
Yes, we do. part, I dare say part of it is sonic and part of it is visual. Part of how we listen is not just what comes to us in our ear, but it's also what we see and how we take that.
Yeah, the other thing I'd like to touch on briefly, well, time goes so fast when you're having an interesting conversation, but the languages. I know this one is sung in Italian mm-hmm. with English subtitles. Different operas are sung in different languages, so you must have been, part of your training and your education must have been in these foreign languages to be able to sing.
Yeah.
In the language.
In university, I went to NYU in New York for undergrad and graduate school. We took diction classes in all of the major languages of the classical tradition, Western classical music tradition, so German, French, Italian, English, and then some Spanish as well. And then I studied Italian and French, the language. And then at the Academy of Vocal Arts in Philadelphia, it was largely the same, going into those languages. And then also adding Russian. But Russian, just the pronunciation of the language, learning the intricacies of the pronunciation, not necessarily directly tied to learning the language from a grammatical perspective. Right. There's a difference there. So every singer that kind of goes through the American education system, I can't speak for Europe, has this baseline capability of pronunciation for French, German, Italian, and English. And it's huge. The work is learning the intricacies of a language. I mean, that it's just crucial. When you're telling a story, you have to know exactly what the librettist was intending the meaning of this word to be or this phrase to be. Oftentimes, it's metaphorical, so you have to know the intricacies of what the interplay of those words are to be able to interpret that phrase correctly.
Of course, when you're singing very dramatically, that's part of the acting.
Absolutely. I mean, my academic path was very similar to John's, both at Catholic University and at Yale after that, in terms of study of French and German and Italian, and some Russian as well. The intimacy of the language is a task that you are working on forever. And it's one that I found, because I live in Brussels now, in Belgium. So my French is improving. I've spent a lot of time in Germany, and my German has improved. I grew up in an Italian-speaking household. And it just helps what we do so much, mm-hmm. to be able to practice language and to make the mistakes that you need to make with language, and to really be able to access that when you're on stage and say, okay, I know what this means on paper, but knowing what it means deep inside of me is something completely different.
That's so true.
Well, don't be scared away. Yes, they're singing in Italian, but on the back of this is an English translation.
Yes.
Plus, I might add, the programs give a pretty good breakdown of often each scene, at least each act, and what is going on.
Definitely.
As you watch the story unfold. It sounds more comedy than tragedy this time.
This one straddles the...
Dark comedy.
Dark comedy, exactly. This is very, very dark comedy, and Alfonso definitely is manipulative, but he himself is even surprised at the end of the night, both by what he's accomplished, but how deeply he feels and how guilty he feels about some of the people that he has redirected and or hurt.
These things happen.
They do.
Of all the operas you've sung, and we don't have a lot of time, but of all the operas you've sung, more of the tragedy vein, people make jokes about this, but the comedy vein or the tragedy vein?
Most of my work is in comedy, although I always find that comedy and evil and what makes us laugh and what scares us are very, very closely related, one to the other.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah,
of course.
And for me, it's been a good mix of the two, I'd say. As I'm running through the roles in my mind and the productions, it's been a pretty even split between tragedy, comedy, and then in the middle there's some of the just grand opera, neither deliberately tragic or comedic.
Yes, indeed. Well, love is never a sure bet in these two gentlemen in their characters, of course. Test their fiancé's loyalty, and you'll see what happens. The show opens on Saturday the 16th at 7:30 p.m. That's just a few days away. Wednesday the 20th at 7:30. Friday the 22nd at 7:30. And then closes on Sunday the 24th with a 2 o'clock p.m. matinee at the Muriel Kaufman side of the Kaufman Center for the Performing Arts, located just south of downtown. The number to call for more information, 816-471-7344, or online. And these days you can do just about everything online, as well as make your arrangements. KCOpera.org. I want to thank my guests for being with me on the program today, and what a fun time I had. Anyway, listening to the stories and the tips and what motivates them. I suspect that at some point in your young lives, and I've heard this from other singers, someone takes them aside and said, you know, with the kind of voice you had, have you ever considered opera? I said, I'm mostly a gospel singer. I said, why don't you try opera? I assume something like that probably happened to you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In my high school days.
I guess there's just something you hear.
I know it.
Say, this is the kind of voice that can be honed to sing opera.
Exactly. That has a natural sound to it that feels operatic to the ear.
Yeah. Well, with all due respects to Freddie Mercury, you need a certain type of voice to do opera.
You do, yeah. 3 years ago, I started a nonprofit called ArtSmart, and there I've had the opportunity to teach a lot of students, and you hear it. You hear in those voices what real, this talent for, this resonance to be able to produce in a natural sound, the operatic way. Yeah.
And once you have discovered that you have an operatic voice, then you start to work on your storytelling through that operatic mm-hmm. voice.
Yeah, and that must be the hardest thing to do.
That's one of the most rewarding things to do.
Lifetime.
Not through words, yes, of course, through words, but singing the words rather than saying the words. Yeah. But as I said, it's amazing how through the gestures and the emphasis on the words and just in the way you react to the person in the scene, you get a gist of what is going on.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I think that comes through in this.
Certainly hope so.
Opening night, Saturday the 16th. Once again, the number to call for more information, 816-471-7344, or online at kcopera.org. I want to thank both of my guests, Patrick Carfisi, who plays Don Alfonso, and John Viscardi, who plays the role of Guillermo.
Good.
In the lyric opera presentation of Così Van Tutte, opening up on this coming Saturday, the 16th. Yeah, they spread the days out because you need to rest your voices, I assume.
Exactly right. Have a couple days to rest. 1 day is usually enough, but 2 days is luxurious.
Yeah, we'll take it.
Thanks so much for coming and telling us about it.
Thank you, yeah.
Hi, I'm Russ Simmons with Freeze Frame, KKFI's weekly look at the newest cinematic fare at your local theaters. The Marvel Universe offers yet another superhero origin story, this time set in the 1990s. Captain Marvel stars Brie Larson as Vers, a member of the alien Kree Star Force. But through a series of convoluted plot twists, she discovers that she's actually Carol Danvers, a former U.S. Air Force pilot, now imbued with high-energy powers absorbed during an experimental aircraft crash. Carol goes through a series of challenges with Avengers honcho Nick Fury, played by Samuel L. Jackson, and must ultimately decide where her allegiance lies. Quality-wise, Captain Marvel undoubtedly lands somewhere in the middle of the pack among the Marvel superhero movies, but it's still good, goofy fun, and Larson displays the acting chops that remind us why she's an Oscar winner. Although the directors and editor lose focus during the early scenes, it all begins to make sense as the plot unfolds. I have to commend the filmmakers for shedding some of the misogynistic, sexist elements of the Captain Marvel comics and replacing them with aspects of female empowerment. And while I'll admit that superhero fatigue has hit many of us by now, the character of Captain Marvel emerges to fill a hole that the Avengers franchise sorely needed. While it's certainly flawed, the millions of Marvel fans out there should still find plenty to like in Captain Marvel. Also opening this week, Level 16 is an unrated sci-fi suspense offering about a 16-year-old girl imprisoned in a boarding school in a dystopian near future. She and a former friend attempt to unearth the truth about their incarceration. The Kid is yet another Western about Billy the Kid. Ethan Hawke plays Sheriff Pat Garrett, and Dane DeHaan plays Billy. Well, that's it for this edition of Freeze Frame. Until next time, I'm Russ Simmons with Fox 4 and KKFI-FM. Freeze Frame!
Play KKFI. That's all you have to tell your smart speaker to get the news, views, and music you love. I remember the first time I told my smart speaker to play KKFI. Within seconds, I was listening to the stream. Pretty cool. KKFI, wherever you are.
Yvonne is a transgender Christian. who feels at home in her community.
But I suppose there was always just that one last thing, which was the reaffirmation of Yvonne Clare in terms of baptism confirmation.
That's next time on Interfaith Voices.
Tuesday at noon, right after Link's Mix.
KKFI is volunteer-powered, but relies on financial support from the community. You can share information about your organization or event with our supporters when you become a community marketing partner. Learn more at kkfi.org/marketing.
This week on Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program, Outcaster Andrew talks with attorney Paul Castillo of Lambda Legal about Title IX and its application to discrimination against transgender students. That's this week on Outcasting.
Thursday at noon, after My Place.
KKFI offers you a challenge, a classical challenge. Every Wednesday from 9 to 11:30, we give you seldom heard and sometimes brand new classical music. Innovative, exciting, and always beautiful. The Classical Challenge, right after American Roots and before From Arc to Microchip. Wednesdays at 9 on KKFI.
Hello, this is Martha Lally, producer of KKFI 90.1 FM's Anything Goes show with Charles Ferrugia and Carol Jean Barta. Hey, Carol, did you know our show was probably accidentally voted the best local radio show by Kansas City Magazine a long time ago? I think that vote was rigged.
Well, listen for yourself. It's true. Anyone could be on the Anything Goes show. Local politicians, charlatans, theater people, and maybe your embarrassing relatives. You better listen.
That's on the Anything Goes show.
Friday at noon.
Welcome back to the Arts Magazine show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station right here in Kansas City. I'm Michael Hogue, your host. Glad to have all of you here, and I want to thank each and every one of you for your support during the recent KKFI Fun Drive. A lot of fun was had by us and the listeners as well. And, you know, it's never too late to give a donation to 90.1 FM KKFI. All you need to do is punch out 816-931-3122, and the person on duty will be happy to take your pledge to help support community radio here in Kansas City, as many of you did, and we'd like to have a lot more of you doing all of that too. So glad to have your support. Can't tell you how much we appreciate all of that. I'd like to fill you in on some of the things we have coming up in the next few weeks right here on the Arts Magazine show. The Kansas City Repertory Theater will be here. They're going to talk about their show, Pride and Prejudice. It's been extended, by the way. Ticket sales are going very well, and we're going to tell you all about the show and all of that that it entails. Nellie Don the Musical. First time we'll be seen here in Kansas City. It's about the famous designer, Nellie Don, and her work in the Kansas City garment industry. It's a musical. It'll be presented at Musical Theater Heritage, and we look forward to seeing about a Kansas City hero from the days gone by, Nellie Don. Cheetah Rivera will be here in early April. Yes, Cheetah Rivera, the Broadway and music star. She'll be having a concert at the Carlson Center. Let's put it this way. Arrangements are being made right now to have Cheetah Rivera come on the Arts Magazine show, at least for a short time, to talk about her career and the show she's doing. And then in May, Karen Ann Knotts. She is doing a one-woman show. It's called Tied Up in Knots, Life with Dad. Her dad, of course, is Don Knotts, the famous actor and comedian. Life with Dad. He was very funny. How do you deal with that? How do you deal with him? All the trials and tribulations involved with that. You know, when he appeared at the new theater, I was told that Mr. Knotts had some vision problems, and that was noticeable in some instances during the blocking that they did during the show, and also in the final couple of seasons of Three's Company, in which he co-starred. You'll notice that some of the blocking he had was kind of limited. But we'll hear about that and many, many other things from Karen when she appears on the show, probably around the first part of May. We look forward to seeing her as well. Today on the show, I'm going to play one of my most requested repeat episodes, Orson Scott Card. He's wrote the Ender's Game series, and he'll be talking about that, and he'll also be talking about the concept of his books being made into movies, and he had some doubts about that, as you'll hear him express during the interview. The movie has since come out, and it's amazing, really, some of the doubts he had came to fruition when you see the movie. So we'll listen to him, his opinions, and hear all about that. So sit back, relax, and enjoy my interview with Orson Scott Card. With us this morning is Orson Scott Card. Orson is the New York Times best-selling author and the author of the acclaimed Ender Cycle series, a series of books that has successfully crossed gender lines by creating a sense of wonder that pulls in readers of all ages and from all walks of life. Welcome to Kansas City, Orson, and welcome to KKFI. Tell me your feelings about the way you've been boxed in as a science fiction writer. Surely you think of yourself as more than that.
I've certainly written science fiction, and I'm proud of it and perfectly happy to have my science fiction novels labeled as science fiction. Fortunately, they don't label my non-science fiction novels as science fiction, so I'm okay. I also have a couple of books in a series that I'm calling Women of Genesis, which are the first one is Sarah, the second one is Rebecca, about the wives of Abraham and Isaac, respectively. And another one will be coming soon in that series about Rachel and Leah. And so, you know, obviously those have nothing to do with science fiction, not a spaceship among them, no time travel. But I take the Book of Genesis quite seriously as a historical document and give it the full historical novel treatment for these really remarkable and interesting women. And I've written contemporary novels that have nothing to do with science fiction or the Bible. And so I'm perfectly content that each type of book finds its own readership. But the science fiction audience is one of the best groups of people you could ever write for. They're very accepting, very open. They're constantly looking for new things. That's the whole point of science fiction, is to not read the same thing you've read 1,000 times before. Now, of course, I have to exempt from that statement the readers of the Star Trek novels and the Star Wars novels, because they are, in fact, wanting to read the same thing over and over again, and they succeed in achieving that. But those of us who are writing science fiction, we try not to write the same book twice. They try not to read the same book twice. So I'm proud to be writing for that community, because they're good readers, and they're very accepting of all the weird things that I try in my fiction from time to time. At the same time, I'd like to think that I write science fiction for people who think they hate science fiction. I don't take for granted that you already know all the tropes of the field, and try to make it accessible to readers who have no idea how science fiction even works. Because science fiction does have its own way of being read. The reader not only has to follow the story and follow the characters the way that you normally would in a mainstream novel, but you also have to be developing your idea of how the world works, what the rules of science are, what the situation is, you know, what the differences are between the reality of the novel and the reality in which the reader actually lives. And those things are brought in detail by detail, bit by bit, in the process of telling the story. And if you're not alert to them, you miss them. So you're really following two streams at once. One of them is the world creation stream, and the other one is the story stream. And it's very easy for a reader who's not used to that to lose track. Let's just say that I try to be as helpful as possible to readers who really aren't used to reading that way.
Well, you're the perfect person to ask to explain time travel to me. It seems that different authors create their own rules for what time travel is.
No, but that's the whole point, is there are no rules, because time travel is actually fantasy. It's not possible, and it is possible. We're all traveling into the future at the rate of one day per day. And so time travel one way along the track is at the same pace as everyone else is the norm, and that's what we all do. But you make up your own rules, and each subtle... When I teach writing classes, I point out that every single change changes every story that you could possibly tell within that world, so that if you decide that you can travel into the future but not into the past, that's one kind of time travel. Or vice versa, that you can't go into the future but you can go into the past. And you make up your own little scientific mishmash stuff to explain it all. Or you make up the rule that you can't send your body into the past, but you can send your consciousness into somebody else who's living in the past. Or that you can take pictures of the past, but you can't go. Or that you can listen to the past, but you can't see. Or, you know, whatever rules you want. Then you can tell a story that uses those rules as a framework. The funny thing is that even though we tell stories set in universes that are different from the present reality, we're still talking about the present reality. We just use those changes in order to focus more clearly the issues that we're dealing with. So that when Ursula Le Guin, for example, in Left Hand of Darkness, wanted to talk about what is actually real and what is not real about gender roles in society, she said it on a planet where the human race had evolved in a direction that made it so that we had a monthly cycle like estrus,
us and many animals, where you didn't know how you, whether at the end of the cycle you would be male or female. Well, then it's not in anybody's interest to make it so that one sex predominates over the other, because you don't know which side of the fence you're going to be on at any given time of your life. And so everybody has the experience of being male. Everybody has the experience of being female from time to time. And yet when you are within that gender, you're definitely of that gender. And so, you know, very interesting idea that allowed her to speak clearly about issues in our society that were really important to her in the 70s when she wrote that. That's what we do in science fiction and fantasy. Even the writers who don't think they're doing that at all. Oh, I'm just writing for escape. That's nonsense. They're writing stories that they care about and believe in. And whether they mean to or not, those stories are going to deal with the issues that they care most about. So we who write science fiction and fantasy are still writing contemporary novels. We're just focusing them differently.
It is said that history repeats itself, and I guess you
It absolutely does. And there's nothing so idiotic that happened in the past that is too dumb to happen again. You know, that people just don't learn from history, especially in America, where it's taught so badly that people have no idea what it even is. And so people are able to tell the most outrageous lies about what went on in the past, and no one catches them in it because nobody studies it. You know, there are a few historians who go, wait, that isn't what happened. Wait. And no one listens. No one cares because we make the past into whatever we need it to be in order to prove our point in the present.
Now, tell me a little bit about the beginnings, the genesis, as it were, of the Ender series. It started out as a short story that you then developed into a full novel?
Yeah, it was the first serious attempt I made to write science fiction, and it attracted quite a bit of attention. It worked better than I expected it to. You know, you always hope that you'll write a story that people will really care about, but when you're starting out, you feel like you'll be lucky if they'll print it and your mother and five other people read it. But it came in second for the Hugo Award when it came out, and that was really very encouraging. But at the same time, you know, I'd already written it, and then I moved on. But then I was going to write another novel called Speaker for the Dead, and the novel really opened up for me when I realized, you know, Ender Wiggin, the character from that first story, should be the main character of this book. But I couldn't get from the end of Ender's Game to the beginning of Speaker for the Dead without going back to the short story and rewriting it as a novel. And that's the only reason it ever came into existence. I was kind of doing it just to set up the other book. Then it turned out to be my most popular book ever. So, you know, maybe it's because I had to relax before I could write it the way it needed to be written. But the truth is, I think that Ender's Game has a particular appeal because it's about human beings who are in isolation, being pressed by other people to do tasks that they really don't want to do. But they go ahead and do their duty and manage to find some nobility and even some freedom in the process of serving the needs of their community. That sounds very abstract, and you'll never hear it in those words in the book. The book is an adventure story, the way that it's presented. But I think that especially with kids who are going to school, a place that most of them don't want to be, and under a lot of pressure to learn to behave in certain ways by society, and a set of pressures to behave in a different kind of way by their peers, that the story of Ender's Game becomes kind of a story about how to find your own way in the midst of unfreedom, to be able to make yourself free. Maybe, but I'm analyzing after the fact. I certainly had no such idea in my mind when I was writing it. When I'm writing a story, all I do is write down the story that I care about and believe in at the time. And if I start finding myself getting bored with my own story, then I realize I've stopped caring. Therefore, something's wrong with the story. Go back and revise it until I do care. And then when I'm all done, I put it out and see if somebody else cares too. And some of my books, the answer is not many people. And some of them, the answer is lots and lots of people. And I'm just glad that I have some that people like, and even the ones that have a smaller audience. I think of my novel, Heart's Hope. It's a very dark and depressing book with a slow beginning, and it puts a lot of readers off. But you know what? I think it's some of my very best writing. And so I'm proud that it's out there, and for those who like it, they really like it, and they're glad that it exists too. That's really, you know, when we talk about writers who are successful or not successful, I mean, the word successful was used in your intro, and I kind of cringe when I hear that because, you know, I'm successful at some things, but I look back at my older fiction. There are flaws in these books, and you know, I've learned how to write better since I wrote them. Artistically, did I succeed perfectly? Never. I don't think I ever will. I don't know of a writer who ever did. But in terms of financial success, that has nothing to do with whether you're a good writer or not. That has to do with whether you coincidentally happen to have cared about and believed in the same stories that large numbers of people will really care about and believe in. John Grisham is successful not because he's the most brilliant writer who ever lived, but because he tells stories that resonate with a very large number of people. So he makes a lot of money. Same thing with Stephen King. King is a wonderful writer. He would be a wonderful writer even if only, you know, a few hundred people read his work. There'd be less of it because he'd have to have a day job. But it's wonderful when a writer can find a large audience. But it has nothing to do with whether his work is truthful or powerful or successful. That's I think there's a different standard of measurement.
Having said that, now it's moving into a whole new medium now. Motion pictures being made from your work. You're working on your first screenplay.
What are the
adjustments?
I've written about a dozen screenplays. You know, you don't just start from scratch and think you can do it. I was a playwright before I wrote fiction, too, so that I've written about 250 audio plays. So, you know, I've done a lot of different stuff and moved from medium to medium. But with screenplays, it's especially hard because you have to please two audiences. You have to write a screenplay that can be read by executives who will then realize that they need to put their money into it. And then the same screenplay is supposed to work as the blueprint for a movie that will be seen, a very different experience, by audiences, and that they'll love it and tell their friends, and they'll all come back and see it 15 times, and it'll make $1 billion. Always the goal of the studio, by the way. Even when they pretend that it's just a little small picture and they don't expect it to make much, they really are hoping it'll be the big breakout that you know, earns worldwide millions and millions of dollars. But the two purposes of writing a script are absolutely contradictory, because it's very hard to read a script and know what you're reading. Very, very hard. And I don't know of many executives who can do it. So you have to write a selling script. And then when it's time to, once you've sold it, then you have to go back and change it into a shooting script, which is a very different kind of thing. And a lot of the stuff that you have to include in the selling script, just so that it'll be clear to the readers, you have to remove from the shooting script. Well, so far I've been writing selling scripts for the obvious reason that they weren't yet sold. This is my first experience writing a script that is actually meant to be the script you shoot. We have executives at Warner who are sharp. They get the story. They understand what it needs to be. I don't have to write a selling script now. They understand how the story needs to go. See, I've had a lot of people whose first reaction to Ender's Game was, well, we can make it into a movie, but we have to change the hero from a 9-year-old into a 16-year-old because we got to get that teen audience. And I just cringe, because the whole point of this is that these are innocent children, and there is no such thing as an innocent 16-year-old. He'd have to be really dim-witted to be non-skeptical of what adults tell him. But, you know, a 9-year-old who has lived in a completely sheltered environment where he hasn't had a chance to have experiences outside of what adults have shaped for him is going to be naive enough to believe things that an older kid never would believe. There's no story if Ender is 16 years old. But so many people have not seen it, and I've just, you know, come out of meetings just despairing that it would ever get made. But I think this time we might be able to do it. Wolfgang Peterson is a wonderful director. Working with him and his partner, Sam Dickerman, they are wonderful, sharp, storytellers. They understand how stories work, and so everything they say adds to my understanding of how the movie needs to go, and they understand everything I'm talking about. It's a great, great experience. There are a lot of good, smart people in Hollywood. You wouldn't know that from some of the films that come out, but they really are, and every now and then, that's why every now and then a really terrific film squeaks through.
Yeah, you talked about in the notes, it talks about the dehumanization of war and the way the children are conditioned through the use of playing a game.
Well, you talk about dehumanization. It's hard to think of an activity more human than war. You don't become dehumanized. You simply dehumanize your enemy so that you can do whatever you want to him. In your mind, you have to, and you have to. You can't go out and start killing somebody if you're sitting there thinking, you know, he has a wife, I wonder how his sister will feel when he never comes home or when I maim him. That's a terrible thing. You can't possibly conduct war if you're thinking that way about your enemy. You have to be thinking, that's a monster who's going to kill me. If I don't kill him, he's going to kill me. And if he gets past me, he's going to kill everything I love. Sometimes that's even true. You know, Adolf Hitler and what he planned to do, monstrous thing. But there were appeasers before World War II who honestly said, why do we need an army? If an enemy came to our shores, I would simply walk out, greet the enemy, and say, what is it that you want? Let's sit down together and let's see how we can get it for you. And I just think, well, that's swell, but what if the enemy says, well, I want to kill all of your Jews, and if you happen to have any gypsies, we'll kill them too, and then all of your children, we'll use them as slaves and take them off to Germany to work our factories. Hope you don't mind. At that point, you think, oh, maybe we do need to fight. But by then, you know, if you're an appeaser, you don't have an army. You have no way of stopping them. You've already lost. There are times when you have to fight. And so when I write a book like Ender's Game, which is about war, or Shadow Puppets, which has war as one of the central elements involved in it, I really don't write that much military fiction, but in this particular series, military themes are important because that's who the characters are, that's what they do. And it's not that I'm anti-war or pro-war. I regard war as something that humans are going to do because we always have, and I haven't yet seen a new species evolving that doesn't have those same needs, drives, and instincts. It's that you have to, you know, it matters a great deal in fighting a war whether your soldiers really believe they're in the right. And I think that one of the reasons that Hitler lost World War II was because most German soldiers knew that, in fact, it would be a disaster for the world if they won. They did their duty. They were loyal to the fatherland. But it was outrageous to them what was being done in their name. And you just can't fight as well when you don't believe in your own cause. Our trouble as a people is holding together a belief in our cause. You know, America is a great nation and stands for great things. We're a flawed nation. We've made plenty of mistakes. But I hear a lot of rhetoric today that would take our mistakes and act as if they trump what we do that's good. And the truth is, there's a reason why our democratic example has been followed by nation after nation. It's because the people who live in a fairly democratic society, one that still maintains good order but is otherwise democratic and reasonably fair, are happier than people who live in dictatorships or one religion states or one party states where there are no options, and if you offend people, offend the wrong people, you're dead. Or you can't work again, whatever. It's better. And we're not imposing our will on other people when we go to war against somebody who would destroy what we stand for. We're instead genuinely bringing a benefit to other people. It's not that we should go out and conquer the world so they can be as wonderful and happy and free as we are. But we do have a responsibility to our own people to protect our people. And we do have a responsibility to help those who are trying to live in the way that we have already demonstrated is happier and better than some of the other ways that you can be governed. There, that's my sermon, you know. But
it was
but,
a good one.
I'm not pro-war. War is it's terrible.
Oh, it's terrible.
No one wants to go through it. But when it's forced upon you, you do want to make sure that you win.
In a work of fiction in general, not just science fiction, you can create your own reality.
Well, that's right. And I set up the rules so that I can decide who the good guys are.
And make it turn out the way you want it to.
That's right.
Do you have any plans beyond this cycle of series?
Oh, I'm writing many different things all along. I have dozens of standalone books that are not part of any series. I have four or five different series going at any given time. They are every kind of science fiction that there is, because believe me, there's more variety inside science fiction than there is outside it. And I have my poems, my plays, my screenplays. You know, I'm busy. The main thing is that it's all writing, because I haven't yet figured out anything else I can do that people will pay me for.
Well, that's interesting. Do you see yourself as a variety, really, more than anything else?
You know what I enjoy best, though? Teaching.
What? Teaching?
Yeah, but you just can't make any money at it. And I have employees I'd have to fire if I ever quit and went into teaching full time.
Can you teach someone to write, or is that something that just has to be?
There are techniques in writing that you can absolutely teach. You can't give people the fire, and you can't give them the stories to tell and the passion to tell them. But you can give them the skills to be able to tell them more effectively, and that's what I do.
Yeah. Well, we've been speaking with Orson Scott Card, the author of the new book Shadow Puppets and the Ender series in general. Thanks so much for stopping by today.
It's my pleasure.
Our thanks to Mr. Card. His series is called the Ender's Game series, the Ender Cycle series, actually. And if you go to your local bookstore, he usually takes up a lot of shelf space. So that's the sign right there of a very successful writer. We want to thank him for coming. Very, very interesting interview that the man did. I hope you all got a lot out of it as well as did I. The Jazz Insider is coming up next. We'll have jazz from 1 to 3, and then in true KKFI tradition, we'll have the blues from 3 to 6, right here on your community radio station, 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio. So until next we meet, ladies and gentlemen at that cross in the road, I'm Michael Hoag. We'll see you next time.